Welcome back to another episode of Real Talk Sundays, the podcast where Russian roulette meets, I don't know, Google it. Today, we're coming right back at you with a very, very, probably our specialist.
Like very, very, very special.
Our most special guest.
Choice says very special, but this is like very, very, very,
very, very special. Cream of the crop special. So yeah, very, very excited for this very special guest. We'll get to that in a minute. But first, housekeeping.
Follow us on social media.
We need to do a new way to do this, but yes, you need to follow us
on YouTube, Instagram, Threads, and TikTok.
Threads and TikTok. What's our handle?
Real Talk Sundays underscore podcast.
Scared me. Yeah. And then naturally too, if you haven't already checked out Kush Cards, you need to go do that. Just a fellow reminder, kushcards.com_ Real Talk Sundays. And check out some really awesome stuff that's going up for Valentine's Day. They have some great stuff for Valentine's Day.
Oh, I bet they do.
But we have no time to waste on any sort of sponsorships or affiliates or any sort of housekeeping. We need to dive into this because it's very important.
We have any time to waste on something we can make money off of.
Skip through that. Let's talk about the real stuff.
In Boise, stays in Boise.
Yes,
because
you need
some
to join
people
us.
Can't handle real talk no matter what day it is.
But for this episode, please join us as we dive into all things medical. I guess not all things. We only have 1 hour, okay? Yeah. We're going to talk about the experience in today's healthcare, ultimately, and the future of medicine. If we get to it, if not, we'll have a part two. But our artist and song of the week is going to bring us a glorious double entendre. So stay tuned for that. And RTS is going to give you some resources as well on how to navigate today's healthcare, because if there's anything we are, it's fucking resourceful. But without further ado, do you want to introduce our guest?
Sure. So a long-awaited guest of honor, like we said, very, very, very special, very highly respected Dr. Cody Fitzgerald. How does that sound to you?
Dr. Cody Fitzgerald.
And you are a pulmonary and critical care doctor. So she is practicing right here in our backyard in Idaho. And we're just so thrilled that you were willing to come on this episode with us, because really you didn't have to, you know what I mean?
You didn't.
No, you really didn't have to.
And we also asked you so many times, we're like, fuck dude, I think this is her way of
trying. I don't think she wants to do this. No,
but
she's actually just really busy and has a schedule and she has a routine.
And she's a newlywed.
Yes, that's too.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys.
Yeah.
Appreciate it.
Very, very happy that you're here. We're blessed, honored, privileged, quite frankly. And we have a lot to get into. And I, you know, as far as like cracking into, we will leave out like all, you know, the hospital mumbo jumbo because we don't necessarily need all of that. But how long, just for reference, tell us a little bit about yourself, how long you've been in the field. And a little bit about you.
Yeah. So, I started my journey to my current position right now a long time ago.
Yeah.
I've always known that I wanted to be a doctor.
That's crazy.
It is crazy, right? I don't have that kind of sense of what am I going to do with my life. I just always knew from the time I was little. I blame a lot of that on a show from the 90s. I know not all of your listeners were around in the 90s, but ER.
Yeah.
Right? ER is probably the reason I went into medicine.
Really?
Or at least I thought that I wanted to go into medicine.
Because of George Clooney? Wasn't he on that?
George Clooney.
That's a Google review and a half.
And
wow.
Like such a, you know, the show is really a lot of drama, really fast-paced, but pretty science-based too as far as a lot of the more medical dramas go. And so from that point on, I kind of just like hit the books and kind of moved through quickly. So I trained at, I went to University of Washington for medical school as well as residency. And then I did pulmonary and critical care fellowship there. Mm-hmm. And then I started being an attending or kind of a full-fledged physician in 2021.
Yeah. You've been at it, and you were peaks COVID as well.
Yeah,
I think was a big one, and so I had to put it on here. I literally was I have to throw it in there.
Yeah.
It's only like one or two questions,
but it's
a necessary evil to just living in today's society as a doctor. And you were ground zero for that, so it was, I think, a bigger one. Would you say, having with your experience in the ER, is it like ER? Is it like the show?
So
in any capacity, even like 5%?
I'm in the intensive care unit, so it's a little bit different. The ER is a kind of one size for all patients. So if you have a cold, you get to come to the ER. If you have a weird skin rash, if your kid won't stop crying, you know, all people are welcome in the emergency department. And there's great laws that support that called EMTALA laws that say that you really can't be turned away if you come to the emergency department, regardless of your ability to pay. In the intensive care unit, we are really taking care of a more specialized subset of patients. So I'm taking care of the sickest patients in the hospital. So generally, by the time someone gets to the ICU, you know, they've seen an ER doctor, if they've been out on the general medicine floor and maybe haven't gotten better, have gotten significantly worse, or are coming in so sick that they immediately go to the intensive care unit.
Yeah. So are we really more dramatic, quite frankly?
because more science-based. They could be close to death. No, like, you know what I mean? That's why they're in the ICU.
Yeah.
But
I guess, too, when selecting your specialty, why this? Why?
Yeah, so I was really drawn to the critical care aspect of it. So I really enjoy taking care of patients at kind of those life and death moments.
That's great.
I know. Maybe there's something wrong with me.
I don't know. Maybe it's a
but
gift.
But it's, I think that the other thing, too, just going back to your question about, like, is it really like ER? It is in some ways, but it's not in a lot of other ways. And I think that one of the things that is so great about my specialty is that none of us make it out of this alive. We are all going to die someday. And a big part of my job is helping people when there isn't anything else to offer from a medical perspective, and helping people to move through that death and dying process with comfort and dignity. And that's a really huge part of my job that I really enjoy.
Do you think it's changed your perspective on death and dying? And
I do. Yeah. I definitely think that I'm a little bit more hardened to things like that, because in the ICU, you know, typically, you're looking at about 20% of your patients are not surviving their ICU stay. So it's very typical for me to have a week where I'm in the ICU where I have a patient die every day. But I think that one of the things that's really great about it is that it's changed the focus of care that I have. Because sometimes making somebody better isn't the only way that you can help them or help their families. Sometimes helping people to accept where they're at and move through that is a big part of their care as well.
Yeah.
I don't know if this was on the outline, but how closely are you involved in that? Because you are the attending. So there's also the nurses, the case managers, I'm sure, and all those people of the team that come together with the family. Like, are you in those meetings? I'm just clarifying.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's different for every, you know, there are types of physicians called palliative care doctors. Who really specialize in symptom management, not just in patients who are actively dying, but kind of with chronic illness. And one of the things that is really special about the group that I work with is that we have a great palliative medicine team to help us. But for me, I find that aspect of my job to be so rewarding and meaningful that in general, I often will do my own palliative care and I'll do my own family meetings.
That's what I was wondering, because you seem like you would be a part of that. Do you know what I mean?
I have control issues.
Yeah.
I was like, some call it, you know, control issues. Other call it being a real good fucking doctor.
By the way.
Which, I mean, is refreshing to hear, because I feel a lot of times, too, everything is about just how many you can get, you know, how many patients you can get seen. It's really quantity or, you know, over quality. And so I think that's always interesting to hear, because it can be done. It just sounds to me like a lot of people don't want to do the heavy lifting. But it's refreshing to hear that there is a lot more out there. And would you say you're kind of one of the rarity as far as giving your above all? I feel like it almost feels like medical school, like, beats the brakes off of you. Like, after a while, then when you're 10 years in the field, you're like, ugh. Okay. But
I don't have to go to that meeting, but I, you know.
Yeah, that sounds like something I can refer out. But yeah, I guess are you stand alone in that aspect? Do you know a lot of your colleagues that have the same vigor?
I do, actually. I feel really, really fortunate to work in a really, really awesome group with a lot of really great physicians.
Yeah.
I think that part of it, too, is that my specialty really selects for people who are going to be comfortable having end-of-life conversations, because most people who don't find that to be not necessarily rewarding, but who find that to be really demanding emotionally and traumatic are going to have a hard time when one in five of their patients is dying, or even one in three of their patients is dying, depending on how bad the week is.
Now, we'll definitely talk to you a little bit more about how to protect your head, because I think that's a huge aspect of this. But if even though it doesn't seem like a question you've ever, you know, had to answer, but if not a doc, what would you do?
I think I would have went to law school, which is stripper. Hilarious.
Stripper.
And then, you know, if there was a job that I could have where I would just, like, have the skills to do it, like, I'd be good at it, but because this is not something I would be good at it. Like,
yeah.
Can you imagine being a cake decorator?
A cake decorator.
Doesn't that sound like...
I'm gluten-free, Cody. No.
Doesn't that sound fun?
No, I don't think I'd ever choose to be a cake decorator. I don't know.
If I had skills.
But that's your dream. That's your dream.
Cakes make people happy. Doctors don't make people happy.
It's your dream. Although, I think that's a great retirement plan or a little side hustle hobby.
Yeah. Like,
oh, man.
I got into macrame over Christmas.
Say that again.
Macrame.
What is that?
You know, like... The 70s, like, hangers. Casey knows.
That's not
Casey
what I thought macrame was. Oh, God, I don't even want to know.
It's like that. Is.
I don't know what that
What's
is. And you know
I'll
what?
Make you guys something.
Okay.
Please do.
For
next cool.
My birthday's
party.
Coming up. So
you have to know.
But, yeah, I think that's definitely where we wanted to start with a little bit more, you know, background on you. Mm-hmm. And then we can dive in, roll our sleeves up, and kind of get into some of the hot takes. But I did want to leave this question on the table because I think it's important for young females out there, because we are diving in heavily into feminist and feminism and having our own series aside from this. And it's been a great start. But what would you say to young women doctors out there, or people who are aspiring to be, a lot of women who are wanting to be? What would you say to them?
Yeah, I mean, I would say, get it, girl.
Get your bag.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that I knew, and I think that something that a lot of women know, is that it's getting better. So in this most recent entering medical school class, I believe for 2023, 2024, 55% of those enrollees were women. And
ooh,
so
I love that stat.
Yeah, so the field is changing. It's getting more Great. Women into school. I think that it's still a little bit of a big boys club in some respects, and it's going to take time to catch up. But one of the things that I love to just bring up is that women physicians have better outcomes. Their patients live longer. They're readmitted to the hospital less, which is weird because sometimes we make less money than our male counterparts. But one of the things that I wish that I had known more about at the time, it's hard to think about this when you're 16, 17, 18 years old making these decisions, is that women physicians make more sacrifices than their male colleagues. And one of the big sacrifices that a lot of women will face who decide to go into medicine is going through a journey of infertility. And so one in four women physicians struggle with getting pregnant. The average age of a woman who has their first baby who went into medicine is 32. And I think that is something that I wish I had thought more about at the time. I don't think it would have changed what I did ultimately. I think I'm super happy with where I'm at. But as someone who's, you know, struggled to get pregnant after going through all of this training, it's not something that I think we're super forthcoming about. Mm-hmm. And it's not something that I feel like is encouraged to talk about.
I agree heavily.
That's like a little sad right now, coming from somebody that women wouldn't think of that because their goals are so driven for this, you know?
Well, I mean, you know, I think this is probably one of the groundworks that we're doing too on just feminism is the understanding of that, and making room for, the entire journey along the way and whatever you're wanting to do. But that's a great gold nugget.
I didn't know that was a real stat.
Mm-hmm. That's really
Did you?
Great. No.
That's why I'm saying I'm kind of shocked right now. So I got to process this.
Yeah. I mean, and I also think, too, I mean, it bears the question that we had mentioned previous, which is just like, given how difficult it is, both psychologically, you know, mentally strained, physically, all the elements that go into becoming a doctor in today's day and age as well, and the continued learning that comes with it, because you never put it down, and having to really move your life around to accommodate this. Would you say contributes or doesn't contribute, I guess, your hot take on what's to come for the future of healthcare for a lot of, you know, up and coming women and just young adults? And because it seems to be fleeting, the urge to belong to this group, you know, to this healthcare. But specifically, our generation is finding better ways, you know, less stressful ways, less demanding ways to make money and, you know, be at the top helping people. So what say you about kind of the future of healthcare with our youth?
Yeah, I think it'll be interesting to see. So that currently the trends kind of support that people are still going into the healthcare workforce, mm-hmm. not just physicians, nurses, nurse practitioners. Mm-hmm. I do feel we know that the age of our population is getting older and older and over. We're kind of moving the bar. And so the need for physicians is outpacing the training that we have. And one of the things that I think really brought kind of healthcare to the forefront is this something I want to do with my life is the COVID pandemic, right? Mm-hmm. Where there was a lot of mistrust in the medical system and people were bringing guns into hospitals and mm-hmm. threatening physicians and following you home. Mm-hmm. And I think that you'd be hard pressed to find any person who's willing to risk their own safety or their family safety for a job where you're actually taking care of other people. So I think that one of the things that's great about medicine is that it's really flexible, right? You can be a nurse, you can be a physician, you can be an advanced practice practitioner, like a nurse practitioner mm-hmm. or a physician assistant. Lots of physical therapy, occupational therapy, and that flexibility is really great because one of the things that this new generation is really looking at is kind of the work-work-die model that we have mm-hmm. in the U.S., right? And it's great that people are rejecting the notion that that has to be the way it is. But it is nice in the sense that I have a lot of flexibility in my job. A lot of my colleagues have a lot of flexibility in their job. I get a fair bit of time off during the month. Mm-hmm. When I'm in the ICU, I'm in the ICU. I work 12 hours a day at least. Mm-hmm. And there are long days and short nights, but it's a great job. I feel really lucky to do what I do.
And don't you also do on-call though? Sometimes I've seen you like on-call, so you're going to get called about your patients and stuff.
It depends a little bit on the group. Okay. Some physicians are in groups where they're, you know, on call for 24 hours. Mm-hmm. Some of them are in more of a shift model. Most of my group is in a shift-based model. Mm-hmm. So most of the time I'm not working outside of a 12-hour shift.
Okay.
I'm just I'm kind of beholden to my phone for that 12 hours.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that makes sense.
And how do you take care of yourself? How do you protect your head? Like, what's your...
Yeah, let's see. Exercise is really important for me.
I fucking bet.
I mean, you know.
Volleyball.
You've seen me at volleyball.
I almost feel like you, like, just by sheer obligation to your, you know, just to what you've decided to do for your life, like, you got to keep your ass in check.
Yep.
Like, that's the accountability and how finally you tote hypocrisy. Yep. Like, you know what I mean?
I do. I do. But, you know, one of the things that's really important to me is time away from work.
Yeah.
And so, you know, today I'm not at work. I didn't check any work related stuff today. I try and really separate my work time from my off time to make sure that I'm giving myself a nice break, because there are times where I need like 3 or 4 days of kind of reprieve after a hard week in the ICU just to kind of settle back out.
Is that something you had to figure out about yourself, or do you always know that, like, I need the downtime to match the uptime?
I think that when I was when you're in fellowship, I was working 80 hours a week most weeks with only 4 days off a month for a good portion of 3 years.
Oh my God.
I was also a fellow during the first wave of the COVID pandemic. And so we were shorthanded everywhere across the nation. We were shorthanded. And I had some co-fellows that went to New York and worked in the ICU. I moonlit, which is kind of it's like a side gig basically at a hospital in addition to kind of my fellowship duties, because we all really felt like we needed to do what we could to try and keep people alive during some really hard times. Mm-hmm. And so when I left fellowship, I thought, oh, I'm going to have all this time. Yeah. I'm going to have, like, it's going to be so great. I have, you know.
Won't be 80 hours.
Yeah, I know. Like, well. And I will say, I still do work 80-hour work weeks sometimes, but I'm working, you know, 14 to 16 shifts a month instead of 24 to 26. Mm-hmm. And that's a really big part of kind of my mental well-being is making sure that I have good time off.
Yeah.
But also, you know, now the buck stops with me. There is nobody, there is no attending that I can call at 2 o'clock in the morning when I don't know what to do. And that, I mean, that's probably a little extreme. I have some really great colleagues that are super supportive, but now all the medical decision making is on me. There's nobody checking my work and looking over my shoulder like it used to be when I was a resident or a fellow. And so
you're who they call.
Yeah. Like, oh, shit. So I definitely that is a different aspect of the job that I don't think you could ever be prepared for. It's just kind of growing into those shoes.
I was going to say, too, you got to really ditch a lot of that imposter syndrome as well along the way. You got to kick that shit to the curb quickly or it can cost you a lot. Yeah. Like there's no time to doubt yourself or, you know, and I think that's yeah, something that's understated a lot is at the end of the day, doctors are just people. They're educated people and they are, you know, as far as dedicated to the craft. But I think that's something to understand is like, whew, you're making the best call at that time, real time. And everything's a learning opportunity. You're constantly learning. God, you must be exhausted.
Yeah, that's how I feel. I think I'm exhausted. And then I hear that. And I'm like, that's not even close.
You know, so it's really good, too, that you're not. I said most of my downtime would be sleeping. Yeah. Like just a recharge.
She's like at the gym. She's rock climbing. Like
doing your best life.
But I do feel like that was also something I had to learn was that it's okay to lay on the couch all day if you need to. And that was really hard when I was a fellow and a resident because for those 4 days off, you're like, oh, must get out. And now I'm like, you know what? I need to listen to my body today. Mm-hmm, my body says, sit on the couch and have an extra cup of coffee.
Fucking do nothing. Yeah,
and do nothing.
Good God, and be okay with that. Mm-hmm. That's so hard. A lot of people, the still. Do you meditate or like?
Yeah, I do actually. So something that I find really helpful is just I try to do like 5 to 10 minutes of yoga a few times a week. And especially too, if I'm feeling really agitated and irritable, I just know that I need to just kind of connect with myself a little bit.
Yeah.
Turn on some, I usually like light some candles in my room, kick my husband out. And I'm just like, this is my MySpace time. And I need to just kind of chill out and have a little bit of me time. And that's been a really helpful thing for me to kind of stay balanced.
Oh, I bet. I think everyone's got to have that like work life, but that's, I think that's got to be a big one. And too, silence, like, to just have no sound going on all the time, just constantly people being wanted, needed. You're constantly doctor. Okay. You're going to be such a good mom. This is going to be so good for you all the time. But I think that's a big one, too. It comes to balance, taking care of yourself. And I think I even wrote this question, too, because I'm genuinely curious. What's one thing that people need to start doing or should be already doing so they don't see you? I mean, love to see the doctor when when you want to versus when you have to.
Quit smoking.
Quit fucking smoking.
Quit smoking all the things. Quit smoking all the things. Quit smoking. Quit vaping. Everything in moderation. Fuck. I feel pretty.
Okay.
I feel like you have to be a pragmatist, right? You have to meet people where they are. And everybody gets to make almost everybody gets to make decisions about their own bodies. Almost everybody. Everybody with a penis gets to make their own decisions about their own bodies. But definitely tobacco. Oh, man. It stops smoking cigarettes. Don't vape. There's, you know, the jury's still out on vaping, on whether or not this is something that's actually a healthy alternative.
New. Like, even if vaping for weed?
I would say, you know, just don't put anything into your lungs.
Okay.
But I'll just tell you.
Figure it out, Amanda.
Practicality.
I am less concerned about my patients who intermittently vape THC over the patients who are vaping tobacco every day or smoking cigarettes all the time, right?
Yeah.
So it's that. Stop smoking.
Just stop smoking. I love that it smells better.
How many years have we been saying to stop smoking and people keep smoking?
But the numbers have definitely gone down. And don't worry, if you're worried about the tobacco companies, it's fine. They bought all the food companies. They're good. They're fine. They'll survive without your guys' money. Don't worry about it. But yeah, I think that's fair advice. And I fucking knew that was going to be the advice because all the people out. What about, you know, and even... people always put up the argument with like cigars and cigarillos and stuff ultimately, but it's just honestly anything that goes into your lungs that shouldn't originally be there. But no, I love this. I knew you were inviting a feminist onto board, but that's, I think, diving headfirst into hot takes. That was a big one.
Segment two.
Hot takes.
I get the question for this.
Go for it. No, I think this was a big one too, because a lot of what we wanted to talk about, we were nervous too. We're like, shit, she don't want to talk about this.
Was kind of hard.
She had to tote the line.
You're just so respectable. We don't want to like put you in a weird situation.
But also too, it's important to have an authoritative opinion about a lot of things that are going on in our healthcare climate. And for God's sakes, we don't know what we don't know. So I think that was a big one, too, is offering this space, the safe space for a lot of people to absorb this information with their guard fucking down. Mm-hmm. And from somebody that, quite frankly, you know, whether or not they trust you in the next 60 minutes is up to them. I don't give a shit. But if they're willing to go to their PCP and ask their value to, I think that's something that can go a long way. So if even one thing of what we're about to talk about resonates with fucking anybody, that's all what I'm here for at the end of the day. But with further ado.
Yes. First question on this. Have you ever felt discriminated against for being a female physician?
This was yours.
I came up with this.
Yeah. Great question. I would venture to say that every lady doctor, every female physician at some point in their career has felt microaggressions, belittlement, frank sexual harassment. Mm-hmm. Definitely during my career, I have had instances where discrimination is maybe too strong of a word for me. I will say part of one of the things that is helpful for me is that I am such a strong personality and I do have a little bit of just like a touch of masculine energy when it comes to things like this.
You almost have to be in your masculine for survival.
Exactly.
Self-preservation at this point.
But she's just saying that she naturally has that.
Yeah. And I think that I have kind of I have an assertive attitude when it comes to kind of.
That's what we like about you, Cody.
I know you guys are shocked by this, but one of the things that I have found in my career has actually been that I have received the feedback before that I'm too direct, or that I wasn't warm enough, or that I wasn't kind of jolly enough. It's basically the female physician equivalent of smile more, right? And one of the things that is supported by that in the literature is that patients expect more from their female physicians. So they expect that you will spend more time with them. They expect that they will get a more holistic kind of emotional and body type of conversation about things. They expect you to be more caring and empathetic.
Yeah.
And those are important qualities for a physician, but why are they only important qualities for female physicians or for female practitioners? Mm-hmm. And so that is something that I find maybe not discriminatory, but it's certainly something that I've dealt with in the past.
You know, definitely. One would almost ask the question, well, if somebody is innately empathetic, shouldn't they get paid more? it's something I don't have to work at. I just naturally am. Shouldn't I just get paid more for that? I think that is a very big expectation in the healthcare industry amongst just globally in general. Mm-hmm. I would really appreciate it if you just put more, exclamation points in your email.
I think people want to feel like someone's taking care of them, like a caregiver, but a doctor's not a caregiver. So I think that's the issue. Mm. Do you know what I mean? Like, don't you want the doctor to fucking know what they're doing compared to, it's going to be okay.
Console you. I'm here
for you. Yeah. But in that moment when someone feels like they're dying, they want to be consoled because they're scared to die. But do you want to live or do you want to be consoled? I don't know. I don't care about the bedside manner, to be honest. I want someone to fucking save me.
Yeah.
That's just my perspective, though.
Well, because you always hear, too, when you're and even asking, too, if it's a deliverer of really heavy news. Like, I got cancer. They always say, cut the shit. Like, cut. Tell me how you would tell me if I was your sister, mm-hmm. or if I was your mother. All right. You have it. And here's where we're at with it. Very matter of fact, to where it's like, it's no matter of yeah, whether it's bedside manner. It's just how good you are at your job and yeah. doing it and delivering that information. But and I think that's hard too, because we've even talked about aspects of your, you know, your job and the where your male counterparts are just simply not asked that. They're just not asked to do that. And mm-hmm. it's just not something that, yeah, it's not, you know, not fair, but ultimately shouldn't inhibit you from getting more money. You should do it all, yeah. all the shit. So would you agree you're a feminist?
I've never said I'm not a feminist.
But you would agree you're a feminist.
I think I am.
Okay, great.
I'm not extreme or I'm not like way up there, but I am.
Yeah, but I think that was probably a big one too that we were talking about, just like within the workplace and like full bore. You're going to see this across the board.
The higher up you get, the more you see
honestly, it. Honestly, it's more cutthroat, mm-hmm. too, because yeah. we've talked about there's not a lot of seats at the top. And so, mm-hmm. you know, and I guess on the aspect, not to turn this into feminism part three, but like,
oh, come on.
With your female counterparts, you I know, the closer you get to that. Have you noticed that the competitiveness and the cattiness and, you know, all the cliche that comes with.
That might be a generalization of what you're saying, but she's saying, have you yeah. seen that because it's survival of the fittest when you get higher and higher up?
How yeah. are you protecting your female counterparts during, you know, yeah, slim pickings at the top?
Yeah. It doesn't have to be your current job. This could be your past.
Yeah, I do think that there's definitely, you know, I feel super fortunate. The people that I work with and the women that I work mm-hmm. with are awesome and great yeah. and super supportive. And I've really lucked out joining the group that I've joined mm-hmm. because I know that that culture is not the norm in a lot of places. But I think that most of the time, one of the things that I had a hard time with when I first started, just to kind of, you know, some of this kind of women climbing mm-hmm. the ladder, is that I've had some interactions with advanced practice practitioners or nurse practitioners who have been doing something longer than I have. Mm-hmm. And I think there's always room for everybody to learn from everybody. But there were certainly instances where I was labeled intimidating or difficult to work with, where a male colleague doing the exact same things that I was doing would have been perceived as like just a normal yeah. old doctor. And so that's there is definitely yeah. that piece of it. I also feel like for a lot of my female colleagues, getting the same level of respect from different people within the hospital can be hard if they don't know you. And so one of the examples that I have is that I don't introduce myself by my first name to my patients. Mm-hmm. And it's not because I don't think, so I introduce myself as Dr. Fitzgerald.
Why wouldn't you?
A lot of my male colleagues in kind of will introduce themselves by their first name. But what happens when I introduce myself as through my first name is that patients will say to me sometimes when I've come back the third or fourth time in the day to check on them, am I going to see the doctor today?
Stop.
Yeah. And I'm like, it's me. Hi.
I'm already here.
It's me. I'm your lady doctor.
You've been talking to me the whole time.
No, that's such a good point. I'm Dr. Fitzgerald, so there's no question about it.
Tirelessly. Yeah. For those credentials, why wouldn't you? That seems...
I think that there has definitely been a push to move towards a partnership in healthcare, right? I think the pendulum has shifted to rely on your physician as friend yeah. It's too familiar, right? Yeah. It's too familiar of a word, but I do feel like this kind of doctor-patient relationship yeah. has shifted over the last mm-hmm. 10, 15 years to be more of kind of a partnership where we're both perceived as on equal footing. Mm-hmm. And I don't think we're on equal footing in the sense that I'm an expert in mm-hmm. my field and you're an expert in your body. Mm-hmm. And those two things can communicate with each other. And in a good relationship, people can work together to make those two expertises mm-hmm. really well co-managed. But I'm not actually an expert in your body. Yeah. I'm an expert in the body.
Yeah.
And not everybody reads the book, right? Not every body reads the book.
And I need you to help me. I need you to help me badly. Ultimately, too, I think where where a lot of lines get crossed is that partnership. And okay, first of all, it's Dr. fucking Fitzgerald. Okay, I was like, I'm still stuck on that. First and foremost, it's Dr. fucking Fitzgerald. And every time that I think about that, it just, that's, that kind of takes me aback because you've just worked so, yeah, you've worked so tirelessly. And we got bigger fucking fish to fry, ultimately. And I've had a lot of male doctors in my day. It's actually a bulk of my doctoral experience. And so experience with doctors. And I think that's one where, I don't know. And I never even knew their first names, quite frankly. And I expect that. And I think it's important to, you know, when it comes to what we call medical misogyny and this gap of credibility. And have you ever felt that from the patient side to where they're just like, okay, I talk to somebody, regardless of, when am I going to see the doctor?
Can we
get an adult in the room? Yeah. Do you have a man doctor you can go grab?
I haven't had a lot of experiences with that. Because I guess it's maybe commingled. I have a lot of patients who say things like, you're so young to be a doctor. You're so young to be a doctor.
It's more ageism, a little bit. Sexism.
That's more of what I experience. I will say that, you know, right now I work with trainees. And so occasionally I will have like a very tall male resident working with me.
Yeah.
And I always make it a point to tell them, like, you can call me Cody outside of the patient room. But like when we're in there, it's Dr. Fitzgerald. Mm-hmm. And the reason that is because they're going to think that you are in charge and you're not.
Yeah.
I'm in charge.
Mm-hmm. And what was the other one, too? I was even thinking, like, I would just say that I have great skincare. Like, I know I'm exceptional. I'm a doctor. I have great skincare. Like, of course I look young. That's beautiful. but no, I don't think that. That's, I think, interesting, too, of more the ageism over sexism. But with the modern girl, you know, with the modern woman era and with a lot of feminism coming into equal pay, equal rights, have you seen a huge shift in this? Are you optimistic, at least for our future in this regard? Like, I feel like this shouldn't be a fucking issue in 10 years. Like, I don't want to talk about this again in 10 years.
Yeah.
Do you feel that's on the precipice or something that is, I don't know, just not delusional to say that we will have equality within at least, you know, the healthcare industry.
Okay, I was like full equality?
No.
Or, yeah.
Like, just within.
She's like, no, Amanda, no. I think there's a lot of work towards moving it in that direction. And I think that, you know, the average age of a physician in the U.S. I think is 55 right now or somewhere around 50 in there.
Okay.
And so I actually looked at a really interesting demographic when I was kind of thinking about some of the things we were going to talk about today. And there was a graph that I saw that shows kind of a trend of like how are women and men broken up across age groups as physicians. So, you know, they took all the physicians in the U.S. Yes. and they said, like, what percentage of you are women and male in each age group?
Yeah.
And, you know, I want to say that, like, at the tail end of, you know, people who are practicing over the age of 65, that tends to be more kind of men. And now the newer demographics for kind of people under 45, and this is like, don't quote me on this, I'm trying to remember the schematic, but really shows that like women are starting to kind of make up most of the workforce.
Yeah.
And so my hope is that as we continue to push forward, get more women in medicine, that more women will go into leadership, more women will advocate for paid maternity leave in the hospital. Mm-hmm. More women will kind of take on research positions and kind of support fostering a better healthcare system.
Yeah, be in the forefront. Yet again, it's your problem to fix the systemic issues at hand, okay?
Oh, my gosh.
So please do it with a smile. I love that. True Real Talk Sundays fashion. I want to talk about the Eiffel Tower fuck that is the healthcare industry.
Insurance?
I put insurance as the front guy.
Okay.
He sounds just really well-dressed, well-mannered, quite frankly. In the back, I put pharmaceutical because, like, every guy I've had on drugs has been pretty nasty. So I put him back there. So that's why I meant the Eiffel Tower fuck that today is our healthcare. I mean, and I even wrote a note on there is like, we all agree that universal healthcare is not the best answer for everything. There's always a caveat, but I think we can all agree that our current standing in our Western culture and our healthcare system, it has gone unchecked. And there's a lot that you're caught right in the middle on that is so out of your personal control, but even as a physician, just physicians, you know, across the U.S. can feel this, yeah, this conundrum. But like, specifically, we'll talk about insurance first, because we all hot take on insurance these days. And there's a lot going on right now in our political climate and just our social media climate about insurance. And that's not what I wanted to spend on. I wanted to talk a little bit about the hurdles that you personally feel when you are trying to provide your best level of care to somebody, the hurdles that you feel insurance are stopping you from clearing.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that is really frustrating for most medical providers, and this is more so, I'm going to just shift a little bit. So this is more so talking about in my pulmonary practice where I see patients with COPD and emphysema and chronic cough and interstitial lung disease. You come in and see me. I've gone to school for, I've done 10 years of postgraduate education, and I meet you. I think you have a particular problem. We talk about that problem. I'm really big on making sure that patients understand what's going on in their own bodies and understanding why I'm prescribing a particular medication and what I hope to achieve with that medicine. And then I send that medicine to your pharmacy, and then your insurance denies it. And most of the time for what I do, it's inhalers that have been around for 20 or 30 years that are just not covered by someone's formulary. And so then that gets kicked back to a group in my office that goes through and sorts out, okay, was it an issue with the actual medication being on formulary? Is it because the indication isn't covered? There's just like 19 different ways that you can screw this up. Meanwhile, your patient's not getting the inhaler that you prescribed. And so one of the things that I find super frustrating about health insurance companies is that I am constantly asked to defend my medical decision making to people who are not my peers, to people who don't do my job, who don't have the level of training that I have. And it results in a fair bit of delay in healthcare for people.
Yeah, for the individual. And I would think, too, just a microcosm of what, you know,
extra work for your team,
the political
too.
Climate as well. Just a minor taste of what is on a grander scale that awaits you. But that was, I think that was just it. I think an aspect of health insurance that is definitely bitched about and murmured about. And I even put this, I was like, what are your personal feelings that CEOs of these insurance companies who are have no right to telling you what you're prescribing, what you're not prescribing is uncovered or covered, just strictly off of business and what I can make money off of, are making on the low end $30 million, on the high end $180 million. Meanwhile, there are so many holes to be filled fiscally with the healthcare industry. And there's so much work to be done that costs money, but yet we're putting the wrong emphasis on the wrong syllable. We're cutting the check to the wrong individuals.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, your raw feelings towards that, I mean, that's gotta hurt.
I think that one of the things, so to me, you know, you kind of mentioned universal. So like, I'm a huge proponent of universal healthcare.
Here.
So I've worked in the VA system. That is universal healthcare. Most vets get better care than most people outside of the VA. And there are problems with the VA healthcare. There's problems with all healthcare. But by and large, in a universal healthcare system, people get the care that they need in a timely manner. And a lot of people will say, well, what about in Canada? You have to wait 6 months to see a specialist. I got news for y'all. You got to wait 6 months to see a specialist here.
Yeah, that's
in
real.
Idaho.
Yeah.
Just because of
who is on your insurance.
Yeah, exactly. And you're still going to pay for it. Fuck. And you may be potentially medically bankrupt for a surgery that's necessary. And so I believe that healthcare is a right. I believe that every person has the right to participate in healthcare. And so to me, the idea that monetization of our healthcare system can go unchecked when it is a money-making entity is just, it's just not possible, right? You're always going to have people who are incentivized to cut corners and do less so that a few of us can make more.
Dang. It's weird too, because I always think about more of a, dare I say, a sales structure when it comes to longevity of patients' livelihood. You know what I mean? It's like, shall we pay out on a different scale? And that's the thing too, is hot. my idea would be to make most insurance companies not for profit and see how the immediate shift, how it benefits literally everybody involved except the CEOs, except for the people at the top ultimately. But don't get me wrong, people with, you know, who work for nonprofits are still getting paid. But that's really where one of the easiest solutions is you make all these insurance companies not for profit and see what happens. And it will change lives overnight, you know, for good and for bad, for humble reasons and for benefit. But it just seems to be such a big problem. You can't seem to get away from it without just a huge overhaul. I mean, what would be your first step into equalizing the I know, like, do you even, because you got to take a bite of this apple one bite at a time, right? This horse one bite at a time. So what would be a baby step towards just off shifting this power? Because it seems to be out of hand.
So I think that Obamacare was a big step towards that.
It was.
I know. Yeah. Let's just all take a moment. Obama. Yeah, Obamacare was a big step towards moving into keeping what I'm not an expert on this by any means, so take everything that I say with a grain of salt. But one of the things that was really great about Obamacare was the idea that everybody was going to have health insurance. And so let's say you are one of the people sitting in this room and you're healthy and you don't access the medical care system that often, and so you choose not to have health insurance. Well, that drives up the rates for health insurance for everybody who does need health insurance. And there were so many other things that were wrong with our healthcare system prior to this as well. You know, the idea that if you had a pre-existing condition that you couldn't get health insurance. Mm-hmm. Isn't that what health insurance is? Yeah. Is to deliver care to people who need it. And so I think that one of the things that we really saw once Obamacare came out was that more people were on health insurance. Mm-hmm. And so that cost got distributed. But the other thing that I just want to bring up is that the U.S. spends about $14,000 a year per person on healthcare. So it's about 18% of our GDP is on our own healthcare.
Yeah.
And we have worse healthcare outcomes than other developed countries who spend less money.
Mind you, I think putting in perspective too, like the bills amount on this, we're talking trillions of dollars, like upwards of, you know, $14 trillion. And there's so much that is just unaccounted for. And it's so infuriating and frustrating. So, you know, the baby step ultimately is like, fuck, go vote. But you know, at the end of the day, you know, and I think a lot of, too, ignorance is educating yourself up on it, because a lot of people, too, were pissed that the Affordable Care Act. I was like, bitch, that's Obamacare. Like, what do you mean? So we were uneducated and we voted. So that's also a double. But I think that's probably, I mean, a safe baby step to just going into the direction of changing this over, because it's, I mean, at this point, it's out of your hands. And we can only advise.
She's just out there saving lives.
Just out here doing my best with what I got. Yeah. Just call me resourceful. But yeah, because, I mean, man. And we could keep going.
There's
on this.
So much to talk about.
We got to talk about the guy in the back, though, because sometimes he's my favorite. And that's pharmacies, okay? It's which, honestly, in a true threesome, which really sucks, because honestly, the pharmacy and the insurance company be banging behind your back and you don't even really know what to do. But ultimately, when it comes to RX, and I really struggle with this, because if you want to talk about the real moneymaker in healthcare, it's pharmaceuticals. Mm-hmm. And this is the
truth.
Yeah,
I think everyone knows that for sure.
Drugs run the world. Drugs. And it's probably
money and drugs.
It's, I think, so difficult too as a physician, you know, and even the markup with the hospital that you are employed on behalf of. And even if you know, private practice as well, you're still struggling with this. I mean, hospitals are marking up upwards of 500%, you know, on average, 500%, anywhere between 200 to 700% on a lot of these pharmaceutical drugs. So like, where is this accountability with professionals on what the hospital is incentivized to prescribe and what is truly best for the patient? Like, how do you find yourself on this balance beam?
I would say that it is very rare that the medication that I am choosing to prescribe while someone is in the hospital is not a formulary equivalent to what a patient needs. So I don't think that I often have to make choices about like choosing the right medicine for the patient, because I will fight that fight if I need to about getting the right medicine for the right patient in the right situation. I think that one of the things that we kind of already talked about is that this is just idea of monetization. And so hospitals will mark up the cost of a drug. Part of that has to do with the fact that they are shipping it, storing it, handling it, administering it, all of it. So there's more to it than just handing you a pill, right? Mm-hmm. But certainly not defending the practice, because really what ultimately happens is that the hospital is not billing you that $500. They're billing your insurance or that 500% mm-hmm. markup. And so it just continues to kind of inflate the costs of healthcare in a reason that doesn't really make sense, because ultimately it just goes back to the consumer, right?
Yeah, but for those who don't have mm-hmm. insurance, you're still, you know what I mean? The problem is still there. The pot is still boiling mm-hmm. when it comes to, yeah, and who's going to cash that check?
Yeah.
Ultimately, the patient.
It'll be interesting to see how some of this legislation starts looking yeah. at minimizing or eliminating bankruptcy for medical expenses.
Mm. Yeah.
That would
or I think it's credit score mm-hmm. reporting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, and I think that's crazy too. Almost like, again, coming back to this, like, longevity of the patient almost being the benefit or the bonus. You know what I mean? Is like the goal ultimately is for them to get off of pharmaceuticals. Like that's irony. At
I
the
think
end of the
that
day.
Depends on your perspective and your what you believe.
Oh, that's not for. Yeah, I guess. I mean, yeah. we'll ultimately break that down for me. Tell me a little bit more about that.
No, we only have 3 minutes, but I'm saying that that's your perspective of pharmaceuticals. That might not be Cody's, that might not be another doctor's. I think my personal opinion is if you have an ethical doctor like Cody, she's mm-hmm. not going to be, oh yeah, here you go, and do that for money. She's mm-hmm. doing that for their care to achieve a goal, like she said. Mm-hmm. I want this med to achieve something, and then we come back and revisit it. Mm-hmm. So that's my own.
I think it's also, and I don't mean to interrupt yeah. you all, but I think it's also really important. I just want to say this out loud, that there are laws that prevent physicians from being paid for mm-hmm. things like that. Mm-hmm. So I don't get kickbacks for recommending vaccines. I don't get kickbacks for prescribing particular inhalers or particular medications. Mm-hmm. There are strict laws that prevent physicians from being in that conflict of interest. Yeah. I can't start a supplement company and then start selling those things in my office and make mm-hmm. money off of that stuff.
Yeah, it comes into like crooked doctors and stuff. They're doing mm-hmm. a side thing, and that's what I think society is like, oh, that's what doctors are doing. Like, you know, it's a generalization.
Or even the element, too, of are the hospitals updating you on preferred, you know, recommendations or saying here's, you know, essentially what we're willing to buy or what we're able to provide in the ICU when you're needed. So you got to look at those people purchasing and the purchasing power of those individuals as well. And I think, yeah, again, ultimately it being out of your hands, but yeah. working for, you know, a healthcare industry to where that is a big driver. That is what it is.
And your point is well taken. And one of the things that is really, there is no cost transparency to your physician. So mm-hmm. I don't know what it costs when I prescribe somebody one antibiotic over the other. I prescribe, and in some ways that's a good thing, right? Like
yeah.
I should be prescribing the right medication for the patient regardless of what the cost is
yeah.
because my goal is to get that person better. But there's not hardly any transparency mm. about the costs of healthcare. And same thing, let's say tomorrow you decide that you're going to go get some sort of surgery. They'll give you an estimate of what mm-hmm. they think that's going to cost, but you won't actually know what your own out-of-pocket cost is for something like that until it's done,
yeah.
typically.
Would you agree I guess not specifics, but an increased information and communication between pharmacy, you know, and physician. Do you feel there's a big gap there, or is it one that you're satisfied with?
I have a great – so I find that most of the time the pharmacy is not – the pharmacy, the pharmacists are – they are almost like an operational, say that three times fast.
We're good.
their goal is to like deliver those medications.
Yeah.
They're to check and make sure that the medications that you're using are interacting. They're almost like a second team member.
Yeah.
It's the pharmaceutical
like
companies that are really.
Hey, it's
that
hard
are really
part too, is there seems
up.
To
yeah.
be an overlap with like the pharma. And I experiencing this with, you know, whether it was my surgery or even my mother's most recent surgery, I saw it again too, and we had to talk about it, was the overlap of a lot of drugs that just shouldn't have been in her possession at one time, especially narcotics. And I think that's a big one too, is this lack of communication or this delay or the lack of the system. I think that's really where I wanted to spend a lot of time, as well as talking about the system of communication that is independent, almost operating in the healthcare industry, is pharmacies operating different from different hospitals, from different, but there seems to be a lag in communication even among pharmacists, different pharmacists. And so, I mean, as far as improving that communication, even having maybe more jurisdiction from a pharmacy to oversee everything and every, you know, anything that has been prescribed or has been prescribed, I feel like there needs to be more improvement on that. And I don't know if it's just me as a patient or a consumer, but it seems to be delayed. I don't know. Very lackluster and a lot of room for error.
And I think that a big part of that is that we are living in an under-resourced healthcare.
Ironically, system,
right?
You have like 1,000 patients to keep track of. Oh, Mark, this person's fine on this for now. Like they have so much going on.
And a lot of times too, you're relying on an algorithm. Oh, looks like this is crossed over with another type of, you know.
And electronic health systems don't necessarily communicate. So let's say you go and get a vaccine at a pharmacy. Yeah. That pharmacy may or may not talk to the immunization registry. And so I may, you know, it just... Mm-hmm. There's not a lot of, I mean, the electronic medical record is like a whole other.
Oh, I know.
We don't have time.
It was a whole segment for sure to where I was like, oh my gosh, we need to talk about this. We also, you know, as far as, you know, just nutrition medicinally, and there was a lot of other elements.
I can't wait for part two. This went by way too fast. Yeah.
It really does. Mostly because it's just a really good, a really good conversation to have.
And it opens your eyes because you can't believe everything you read on TikTok.
You really can't.
Yeah. Or like social media. And she's like, no. This is my training. This is my this is my stuff. This is what I do, you know.
Is there any final words or words of wisdom or any like, you know, or a what
don't
the fact?
Don't smoke.
Don't fucking smoke. Don't or smoke. A what the fact or a tidbit or another gold nugget to leave everyone with.
Yeah, I think that in this day and age, you have to be your own advocate for your healthcare. And that doesn't necessarily mean going to the doctor, right? Depending on how healthy you are, seeing a physician every year has not necessarily been shown to improve health outcomes, kind of the wellness exam that they were touting. And it's great that most all health insurance now requires an annual come in and sit down with your doctor, and we're going to pay for that to chat about all of your routine healthcare screening. That's really important. But there is no replacement for living a healthy lifestyle, as silly, like as ridiculous as that sounds. Like there is no magic pill or supplement that is going to make you healthier if your diet sucks and you're not exercising and you're not taking care of your body and also taking time for your own mental health as well. So I think be your own advocate is a big thing.
Because you're an expert in your body. Mm-hmm. All right. Ah, that is good words of wisdom. No, on our way out too. Well, we're excited to have you back. Thank you for already previously agreeing, because we'll hold it because we have it on record. So you're absolutely going
basically
to
signed.
You're basically a paper. Signed with us.
Our lawyer's here.
Absolutely.
We our have lawyer a mutual is present. Lawyer. How does that work?
And witness. but yeah, as far as the song and artist of the week, we will never leave you hanging. In true double entendre fashion, your artist and song of the week is going to be Drown by Kim Dracula. So give that a listen. It's definitely, I think, a great jam, especially for your working out. I highly recommend working out. But on the screen, too, and in our bio, if you're only listening, we're going to have a bunch of free resources listed to help you navigate healthcare, all the way from free legal advice to free patient advocacy. So if you are needing, it's about 6 different resources that are available to you. We will have those listed. So go clickety click, click, click. And then, yeah, share, like, follow.
Like our YouTube, Instagram, TikTok, Threads. That's my only job is to say something.
Oh, you're a good reminder.
So, thanks, Cody.
Yes, thank you, Dr. Fitzgerald.
Oh, sorry. Thank you, paging Dr. Fitzgerald.
Fuck that, Cody. Dr. Fitzgerald. Until on your gravestone. MD. Like, quite frankly. Oh, I guess last question off the cuff for you. Do you plan on furthering those credentials? Are you?
She's a doctor.
Well, no. I mean, as far as you can add more.
No, I know. I was just got all the letters I need.
You're good.
Oh, I'm done. I'm just taking care of patients. I'm not climbing the the corporate ladder.
Fuck all that. Yeah. Oh, good for
Love
you.
Love that.
Well, thank you so much for everything.
Yeah,
your service, your information. We out.